Hey, you guys, time once again for Tomes of Terror, where I talk about horror books. Now, the book that I'm talking about today is a goddamn classic. I will say, because the book is so old, and because the film that is based on the book is so old, there will be spoilers because I kind of feel like most people probably know the story of this, so I don't feel too bad about spoiling it. And I do actually kind of want to talk a little bit about the differences between the book and the movie adaptation, which are surprisingly few. I guess it's not that surprising, but we'll get into that in a little bit. The book that I'm talking about is from 1973, and it is by Robert Marasco, and it is called Burnt Offerings. Now, this is actually my second read of this book. I don't know if you know, but this is actually a pretty classic, probably one of the big five, I guess, haunted house novels, that get brought up a lot as being really influential. The other ones being obviously The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson, The Shining by Stephen King, Hell House by Richard Matheson, and The House Next Door by Ann Rivers Siddons. All of those books are excellent and are all very influential. We're all influential, like in the haunted house kind of genre. And I feel like Burnt Offerings is probably like the least known and the least read of those. And that's really a shame because this is really, really a great book and easily, like I said, one of my favorite haunted house novels of all time. And you can totally tell that Stephen King used this book as sort of an inspiration for The Shining. I will note too that sadly this book was out of print for a very long time, but good old Valancourt Books, who are awesome, put out this edition that I have here with this cover is like kick-ass if you can't really see it. It's kind of like a face, which I didn't even notice when I first bought it, with like the trees growing on top of it and stuff. They put this out in 2015, and it has an introduction by Stephen Graham Jones, who's written a whole bunch of stuff and also wrote Night of the Mannequins with the novella that I talked about a few months ago. So it's a really nice addition, and I really like that they're kind of bringing it maybe back to the forefront. Because, like I said, out of the big five haunted house novels, as they're sometimes called, I feel like this one is the least read. I feel like a lot of people, like horror fans, I guess, have like seen the movie, which came out in 1976, but I don't even know if a lot of people know that it was based on a book or read the book or whatever. Now, how I ended up reading this the first time was, I don't know, like Stephen King, he wrote a nonfiction book called Danse Macabre, way back in the day, like in the early 80s. And he was kind of talking about, it's all about horror movies, about horror books, horror TV shows, just kind of like horror in culture in general from 1950 to 1980, with some kind of sideways stuff back about, the classics of literature like Frankenstein and Dracula and everything. Now, at the end of that, he had this massive list of books that he hadn't really talked about all that much in the text, but books that he still like recommended. So he had this really big, long, I think it was like 50 books or 100 books or something. It was like some ridiculous amount. And for whatever reason, when I was a teenager in my early 20s, I said to myself, I'm going to read as many of these books in this index as I can get my hands on. And one of them was Burnt Offerings. Now, at the time, like, this was probably the mid to late 80s, I want to say, somewhere around that area. And I don't know if this was out of print at that point. I actually ended up checking it out of the library, and I really, really dug it. I think I had seen the movie first, because I think the first time I saw the movie, and the movie is one of my favorite haunted house movies from the 1970s. It's just really good. Karen Black, Oliver Reed. It's just a really good movie. And I saw it at a slumber party for my friend Tanya. We were staying at her house, me and a bunch of other girls. I can't remember who all else was there, but we were watching Burnt Offerings. And if you've seen the movie or read the book, and you know about the chauffeur that turns up in this, like in some of the, we were all like pretty freaked out by that. I mean, you have to, we were only like 12 or 13 at the time. So I think the first time that chauffeur like appears on the screen, we all just like ran out of the room screaming because it was like so upsetting. But it's like, if you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. That's like super, super creepy. But so I'd seen the movie first, so I kind of knew it was going to happen. But that even made me more curious about what the book was going to be like. Now, interestingly, Robert Marasco, from everything that I could determine, he was a teacher, and this book was actually originally written as a screenplay, but then it was sort of turned into novel form. Now, Robert Marasco, as far as I know, this book, and he wrote another earlier book called Child's Play. It was nothing to do with the Chucky movie. It was kind of about like a psychological horror thing about students and teachers. He wrote that like earlier, but I think those are the only two books he ever wrote, which is kind of a shame because this is like a pretty kick-ass book. So if you don't know the story behind it, the novel follows a family, the Rolfs, Marion and her husband Ben, and they have an 8-year-old son named David. Now, this family, Ben is a teacher, and Marion is kind of, a stay-at-home mom or whatever, and they live in this fairly small apartment in Queens, back in the day when you could actually afford to live in an apartment in Queens on a teacher's salary and no other salary. It was the 70s. So there you go. So they live in this apartment and they go away every summer, but they usually just go, upstate New York or whatever. But this year, Marion has decided, we really need to get away from this place. The apartment, it's very noisy, it's, dirty. It's like there's always good. So she always has kind of something to complain about. And she finds this ad in the newspaper. And they're basically like, okay, well, there's this house and it's really remote and isolated. It has a pool, it has like, beach or lakefront access. And it's very reasonable for the right people. That's what it says. Now, she gets very excited about this and ends up showing it to Ben, and Ben is just very skeptical. He's like, look, one, we haven't seen this house. What does very reasonable mean? What does the right people mean? It's like, this really doesn't sound good. He's trying to talk her out of it. He's like, what's wrong with going, upstate and staying in a little cabin up there for 2 weeks like we usually do? And she's like, no, I really want to do this. And she finally pretty much nags him into at least going up and looking at the place. So they drive 2 hours up to this house. This house is indeed very isolated, and it is not just a house, it's essentially an estate in that there's massive, like acres and acres. I think it's like something like 200 acres or something like that of like gardens. There's like, cottages, there's a bay, there's all this other, there's a boathouse, there's all this stuff. And when they first drive up to it, they're like, this can't be it. This can't be reasonably priced. And Ben's like, yeah, there's no way. Even if it's very reasonable, we're not going to be able to afford this shit. And honestly, the first time they drive up to it, they think that what's being rented out is this crappy looking little, cottage that's on the land that apparently the gardener used to live in or whatever. So Ben's just like, no, we're turning around and going home right now. This is a stupid idea. It turns out that he's right, but he is kind of cranky about it. But finally, Marion's like, please, can we just, go and talk to the lady? She had talked to the lady on the phone, Roz Allardyce, and she's like, she's expecting us. So they go in there and they meet Roz Allardyce and her brother, who is mostly just called Brother. I think in the movie he's called Arnold. I don't remember if they ever refer to him as Arnold in the book, but because mostly she just calls him Brother. And these two, there's also a like a groundskeeper, caretaker type of dude named Walker, who's kind of a pig, but you know what I mean. It's like at least Marion's gonna say that. So these two, like the brother and sister, the Allardyces, are pretty weird and pretty eccentric, not necessarily in a threatening way, but just in a real kind of like, hey, these are kooky old people kind of way. And because Ben's like, the cottage looks like crap, and it's like, we want to know what the price is and everything. And they're just like, initially they say $700, but then they say $900. $900 to live in what is a 30-room mansion for 2 months, like essentially the whole entire summer, like from July 1st through Labor Day. Now, the mansion is kind of run down, but it's just this massive, there's so many like beautiful things in it, like all these antiques and everything. And Marion's just going around like goggle-eyed, like looking at it, just like, oh my God, I can't believe they have all these gorgeous, expensive things and they don't really take care of it because everything's kind of covered with dust and everything's kind of peeling and stuff. And she immediately feels an affinity with this house, and she just will not take no for. She's like, we are going to do this. So, I mean, and $900 for a whole summer in a mansion on an estate with a pool and everything like that, they're like, yeah, that's pretty reasonable. And so they talk to these two weird siblings that own the house. And Ben's just like, man, this house is like so big. It's like, how are we gonna take care of it? It's kind of falling apart. What if something bad happens? And he's always just trying to think of like the worst thing. But Mary's just like, no, please, 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 I really want to do this. And they kind of go back and forth about it. But then the brother and the sister, because Ben's like, well, what's the catch? It's like, there has to be a catch. And at first, the brother's just like, no, there's no catch. But then they're like, oh, well, yeah, there is one tiny little catch, but it's not even that big of a deal. They're like, basically, Our elderly mother, who is 85 years old, will be staying in the house over the summer with you, but she stays in her room all the time, and it's very likely that you will never see her because she's very, very private. All we ask you to do is take her a tray of food 3 times a day. Take her some breakfast, take her some lunch, take her some dinner, and that's all you have to do. You will probably never see her, and it's just not even that big of a deal. So at this, Ben is kind of like, well, that's even more fucked up because, like, this is an old lady. What if she dies? What if something goes wrong or whatever? And it's like, no, it's going to be totally fine. So, like I said, they go back and forth, but finally, Marion gets her way, and they end up taking possession of this house for the summer. Now, the thing about this house, very much, and you can see how Stephen King was really influenced by this book and also by The Haunting of Hill House, which I think that Robert Marasco had also read The Haunting of Hill House too, because Stephen Graham Jones, in his introduction for this, he's basically saying, well, okay, there's two kinds of haunted houses, like in novels. There's a haunted house where something bad happened, and there's ghosts. And then there's what is called a hungry house, which is what Hill House is, which is what the Overlook and The Shining is, and is also what this house is. This mansion, essentially what it is, he doesn't spell it out exactly, but it's pretty obvious that what this house does is that it's able to insinuate its way into the people that are staying in it and sort of attacks their weaknesses, knows enough about their weaknesses to know how to get to them. And it's essentially draining their energy to restore itself. Because when the family first comes into this house, like I said, there's all of these beautiful things in there. It's a beautiful house, but it looks like it's kind of been let go to rack and ruins. Like no one's really cleaned it. It's like, not really maintained. But as the weeks go on, as the Rolfs are there, and Ben, in particular, starts acting really violent, and he has these kind of blackouts. Like there's one point where he almost drowns his son, and he can't really remember why he did it. There's one point where he essentially almost like rapes his wife and doesn't really remember. He has like these blackouts. They end up bringing Ben's Aunt Elizabeth, who is in her 70s, and she was real spry and everything before she came to the house, but then she just starts getting sicker and sicker and she can't like move. So the house is just like draining everything out of everyone. And then things start essentially fixing themselves. Like the first thing that Marion notices is that the swimming pool, which was kind of fucked up and brown, and like, the paving around the pool is all cracked and uneven. But she notices one morning when she's looking out the window, she's like, oh, well, now the pool is clean, even though Ben hadn't been able to get the filter or the pump working correctly. She's like, the pool's now clean, and all of the paving stones and stuff like that around the pool are now just pristine. And that happened the day after Ben freaked out and almost killed his son. Like they were kind of horsing around in the pool, and then he just kind of like a red film goes over his eyes or whatever, and he just like starts freaking out and like slamming the kid down in the pool. And later he just feels really bad about it. He said, I don't know what happened. I wanted to kill him and I don't know why. And so it's the house working on everyone insidiously. Now it's draining the other three members of the family, Ben, Aunt Elizabeth, and the kid to a lesser extent. I feel like the kid, he doesn't really factor into the story too much, just to kind of be, he's eight, so he's kind of the one that's always getting endangered. At one point, the house makes Aunt Elizabeth, or implies that it makes Aunt Elizabeth, go into his room and turn the gas heater on and then lock him in there. And, they save him before that happens. But the house is kind of trying to get rid of them. However, Marion, the house has essentially done what Hill House did to Eleanor in The Haunting of Hill House. It is making her feel like this is her house, this is her home, this is her place, and it's her responsibility to take care of this home and make sure that it comes back to its own, to its former glory. Now, I will note that she is very, very strict about none of the other members of the family are allowed to go into Mrs. Allardyce's, Mother Allardyce's. She has a sitting room and a bedroom. So Marion goes into the sitting room, like to leave the tray, like for the old lady that's supposedly in there. And most of the time, the food is never touched. The only time that the food is touched and it looks like somebody came out and ate was when Marion starts to suspect that there might not actually be anybody in there. It's so the house is kind of like stringing her along, but nobody ever sees this supposed old lady that supposedly lives in this bedroom, which is like super, super creepy. And that was one of the, I think that was one of the things that creeped me out the movie, in the movie as well. But the house is taking over Marion to a point where she starts wearing Mrs. Allardyce's clothes, like that she finds in the sitting room. She starts decorating the sitting room all pretty. Like she finds all these amazing, like all this amazing, like gold candlesticks and like crystal. And she finds, and she just spends all of her time working on this house and cleaning everything and making everything beautiful, even though, and her family are just like, where the fuck are you? It's like, we're supposed to be having a fun summer, like hanging out of the bay or swimming in the pool or whatever. And she's always in the sitting room, just like sitting in there staring or cleaning something or something like that. So she's just become obsessed with fixing up this house, even though in a lot of ways, the house kind of fixes itself as it drains the energy from the other family members. So that's kind of the whole story of it, is this house is essentially like a living organism that restores itself by draining people's life energy, turning them against one another, turning their weaknesses against them, things of that nature. But there's always kind of one caretaker, I guess, because it's implied that this is, you know, the Allardyces, the people that own the house, that have done this lots and lots of times, because they find like all these, in one of the rooms, they find all these photographs of the house, like looking really awesome, that look like they go back like 100 years. So every year or every 2 years, they have somebody different stay in this house. And they're like, hey, we're going off on vacation. You can rent the house out for cheap. And, you know, horrible things happen in the house, and the house like restores itself over the summer. And there's nice little subtle indications of the past stuff. They don't go too much into it, which I think is good. But, you know, it's like Ben finds a broken pair of glasses, like the bottom of the pool. When they first get there, David, the son, finds like a tricycle with some blood on it, like in these bushes and stuff like that. But that's kind of as far as it goes. So you know that it's been done a bunch of times. And then there's also all these photographs of people in Mother Allardyce's sitting room, and Marion is like looking at them, and she's like, man, you know, these pictures go way back, you know, again, like 100 years or whatever. And she's like, the expressions on the faces of the people in the photographs are really disturbing. Like they look like they're really scared and stuff. So it turns out, and I don't remember if they did this, if they had this in the movie or not, but in the book, it turns out that all those pictures are people that had stayed in the house, and the house had essentially drained them or killed them or whatever. Because at one point, and as I said, there's going to be spoilers, so don't get mad at me. Because like I said, this book is damn near as old as I am, and the movie is almost as old as I am too. So it's like, you know, if you haven't seen the movie or read the book, then probably go do that and whatever. But at one point, Aunt Elizabeth, who has been, you know, getting sicker and sicker and weaker this whole time, she eventually dies. And Marion freaks out because she goes up to the sitting room, and then suddenly one of the photographs is of Aunt Elizabeth. So all of these people in these photographs are obviously dead, and like the house had drained them and used their energy to restore itself. So interestingly, as I said, the movie adaptation, which came out in 1976, is alarmingly faithful to the book. I mean, it's almost exactly like the book. There's only a couple changes that were made, which, like I said, I guess is not that surprising, because the book was apparently written by Robert Marasco first as a screenplay, and then he novelized it. And then I guess essentially they went back and made it into a screenplay again. So it's almost exactly the same. I'm not saying that if you've seen the movie, you don't have to read the book, because obviously those are two different experiences. I'm just saying that, you know, there weren't really a lot of changes made. And I think that was a good idea, because it's like a really good novel. It's really creepy. It's really insidious. I really like the slow buildup of like, what the fuck is going on in this house? Like, who's like, is that old lady really in the room? Like, what is this house doing? Every time somebody, you know, every time the kid falls and scrapes his knees, like, you know, a plant in the greenhouse will grow a new shoot and stuff like that. So it's like, I really, really like this kind of really stately buildup of the weirdness. And it's also really cool too, the way the house gets in between everybody, like, because it divides everybody. Like I said, Marion, you know, as soon as she walks in the house, like before they've even rented it, she's like, yeah, this, we're going to have this place. And she just will not take no for an answer, and just kind of nags and nags and nags and wheedles Ben until he finally gives in, even though he doesn't really want to. And he thinks the whole situation is suspicious. I mean, obviously he doesn't suspect that what's going to happen, because why would you? But he just thinks there's something weird about the whole situation. He doesn't like the Allardyces. He thinks they're weirdos. And he's like, I don't like the idea of having to take care of this old lady who we don't even know. And, you know, and it turns out that he's right. But Marion's whole thing is the house sees that there's kind of an underlying implication in this, that Marion, because she wants something that is so far above her station, I guess, because it's like she is the wife of a teacher. You know, they have a kid. She's kind of a stay-at-home mom. They have an apartment in Queens, which I guess isn't a shithole, but it's not like, I think she aspires to grander things. So as soon as she comes into this house, she's like, yeah, this is the kind of life I deserve. And she just becomes obsessed with it. So it's just kind of like her entire obsession with, I mean, and it's even named in the book, like when it's from her point of view, she's going around saying, oh, it's, she knows the names of like all the, you know, the antiques and like, you know, what brand, like all the vases and everything like that. She knows what everything is. So you can tell that she's really kind of aspirational in that sense. And that's exactly what the house uses against her. And it gets to a point where she is just so obsessed with the house that it becomes almost like a living creature to her. And she gets to a point where she doesn't really give a shit about her family anymore, which, like I said, is one of the main things that was changed from the book. Now, one of the things that is that's not in the movie, but is in the book, is that there's actually at the beginning of the book, and this isn't a long book, it's only like 250 pages or something like that. The beginning of the book, there's actually a large amount of time spent with the Rolfe family in Queens. So they're trying to establish how this apartment is sort of how Marion feels about living in this environment. Like, even, like I said, it's not a shithole, but it's noisy. You know, there's an old man that like pees on the mailboxes in the lobby. It's like that kind of shit. It's like, you know, living in New York City, and she doesn't like it, and she thinks she deserves something better, which is why she just keeps pushing and pushing that they need to go somewhere. So, you know, like I said, she's very aspirational. So a significant portion of the, not a significant portion, but probably like the first quarter of the book is the family in Queens and them and her and Ben going back and forth about renting this house. So they do kind of go a little bit more into the backstory. I believe in the movie, which they moved the location of the movie to California because that's where the, you know, the mansion was that they shot. So they're making it like that's where the summer house is. But the book is actually set in New York City. Like I said, they live in Queens, and the house that they go to is actually, I think, on the eastern end of Long Island, I think is where it's supposed to be, like just this real remote estate. So they did change that. They took, the movie doesn't have any of that stuff. I think it pretty much just starts with her being like, hey, here's this ad. Let's go check this out. I don't think they spend that much time with them before they go to the house. Another interesting thing they changed was toward the end. Now, like I said, the book is almost identical to the movie, but the book, I was actually reading, Grady Hendrix has a really great blog. He did a book called Paperbacks from Hell, which is nonfiction, and he kind of talks about a lot of the pulp horror, the paperback horror that came out in the 70s and 80s. And I have the book back there, but I haven't read it yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. But he has sort of a blog where he talks about these kind of forgotten bestsellers. And one of the ones that he talked about was Burnt Offerings. And in there, he said something really interesting. He didn't really care that much for the movie, but he was talking about how good the book was. But one of the things that he said in his breakdown of it that I thought was really interesting, he said the book is so much more cold-blooded than the movie. And I know exactly what he's talking about. In the movie, the same shit happens where Marion gets obsessed with this house and starts to neglect her family and starts to care less about them because, as I said, she's just become obsessed with taking care of this house and essentially becoming Mrs. Allardyce, because spoiler alert, like I said, there actually really isn't a person in that room. It's just kind of like a force, and it kind of takes over a person every single time, and then they become the next one, sort of. But in the movie, it's like towards the end, there's a scene where the kid like falls in the pool or the bay or something like that and starts to drown. In the movie, Marion kind of snaps out of the shit for a second and then like jumps in and saves him. In the book, that does not happen. In the book, what ends up happening is that Ben has seen, he saw like the chauffeur that he sees, like it's a recurring nightmare from his childhood that freaks him out. And he, you know, in the book and in the movie, like he sees the actual chauffeur in the car, like the funeral car or whatever. And he sees it in real life and it starts freaking him out. So he kind of feels like he's losing his mind too. And he finally sees it in real life after Aunt Elizabeth dies. It's this horrible traumatic thing. And he just kind of goes into a like catatonic sort of state. So he's sitting by the pool and his son is drowning and he can't move like to save it. So in the movie, Marion like rushes and pulls him out of the pool. But then both Ben and David die later when they're trying to escape, like the house falls on him, like, you know, or something like that, or bricks fall on him from the chimney. So they do actually still die in the movie. It's just that Marion actually tries to save David, but then they die later. In the book, the same shit happens with Ben catatonic sitting on the thing watching the kid drown. But the kid just drowns and Marion doesn't lift a finger to help him. So I think that's what Grady Hendrix meant when he said that it was cold-blooded, meaning that Marion just kind of thought about it for a second. Oh, David's dying. Eh, don't care. Like she gave like no shits at this point. So this is the way the book is structured is really interesting because it jumps back and forth. It's not in the first person, but it's kind of like omniscient third person, I guess. So it jumps back and forth between all of their perspectives, sometimes in the same section, which I thought was a little weird because usually it's, you know, usually if you're jumping from perspective to perspective, you would go to a different section. It doesn't necessarily always do that, but which I thought was kind of strange. I don't know if I've read any other book like that where the perspectives like shifted. Like I said, you'd be thinking of things like Marion's thinking about things and talking, and then suddenly she'll be talking to Ben, and then it'll go into Ben's, you know, the what he's thinking about. So it'll kind of move over to him without changing sections. And it's a little bit weird, but I guess I don't know. It wasn't like hard to understand or anything. I just thought it was a little strange that it did that a couple of times without, you know, making a delineation. But as I said, that's not even a criticism because it didn't bother me and it didn't. You know, I just said it was unusual. That's like not something you see a lot. But yeah, so if you have not read Burnt Offerings, if you've seen the movie and you want to read the book, like I said, they're very similar, but there are some differences. You know, it's not really the case that even though the movie is so similar to the book, it's like, oh, you don't have to read the book then, because that's dumb. You know, the movie's awesome, but the book just has, I don't know, like more detail, more kind of shit, more like what's going on in people's heads, which I think is particularly interesting in the case of Marion, because you can see her obsession growing and how her caring about her family just starts to be like eroded away until at the end she's just like, whatever, I don't give a fuck what happens to him, I just want him to go away. So that's kind of cool too. But I like that it's shifted perspective. You know, Ben thinking that he's going crazy because he's like, he starts to realize what the house is doing, but then he's like, that can't be what's happening because that's what you would think in real life. You know, and then he starts seeing the chauffeur and he starts seeing these other things and he just like starts wigging out. So it's really fascinating, not only the insidious nature of what the house is doing, but just the fragmenting of the family unit and like, you know, what's going on with all of that. And I love the concept of a house that is like an intelligent organism. Like I said, in a lot of ways, this was very, very influential to The Shining, which like, you know, the Overlook does pretty much the same thing, or like drains people's energy and uses that to like, you know, sustain itself. This is kind of the same thing, except the house gets run down and then it needs new blood, new meat, like to come in there. And then every time like they start getting hurt or dying or going mad or whatever, the house like just drains all the energy out and starts kind of like making itself look gorgeous again. Yeah, if you haven't read it, like I said, Valancourt Books just did a new edition in a newish edition in 2015 with a new introduction, and I would really recommend it. I really feel like more people need to read it because it was just so influential, and I feel like it kind of got forgotten about a little bit. Even the movie is kind of forgotten about, but maybe not as much as the book. Like I said, I think a lot of people might not even know that that 1976 movie was based on a novel. So I would definitely, definitely recommend it. One of my favorite haunted house stories of all time, easily. And I was really, really happy that I got to reread it again because I haven't read it for probably 20 years, you know, for this show. And that was, like I said, one of the things I wanted to do was reread some stuff that I hadn't read in a long time. And this was definitely one that was on my list. So check it out. It's awesome. And I will see you guys on the next one. Bye.